Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name is James Henderson. I'm Director of Energy Transition at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. And I'm here today with two of my colleagues, Mike Fullwood, who's a Senior Research Fellow, and Jack Sharples, who's a Research Fellow. And the topic today is the Russia-Ukraine crisis and its impact on European gas markets. A paper was published on this topic on the 7th of March, and we're here today on the 10th of March. And so things have moved on a little bit, but Mike and Jack, I'm sure, are going to give us an update. So Mike, Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jim. Welcome.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be here.
So Mike, let's start with you. As I mentioned, the paper came out two or three days ago now. We're here on the 10th of March. Gas prices have been moving around all over the place. Perhaps you could just give us a bit of background and sort of set the scene with where we are today.
Yes, thank you, Jim. I think saying just the 10th of March is probably not good enough in the current climate. I think it's the 10th of March at 10:23, I think, is the, given what's happening to prices. I mean, they've kind of been all over the place. Clearly, they rose sharply as a consequence of the Russia recognising the two republics and then obviously the invasion. And they pretty much doubled in the matter of a few days. And it's been a little bit up and down. I mean, we saw one day when they were up 40%, then fell back another 20%. And yesterday, they sort of fell 25%. This is the day ahead or the month ahead price. And this morning, started off sort of leveled out. Then all of a sudden fell 10%, and then 10 minutes ago they rose back another 10%. So the market is very volatile, but in summary terms, since before the invasion, prices have doubled, basically. So in terms of dollars a million BTU, it's doubled from $25, $26 to around about $50. So there's a huge volatility in the market. A lot of it's to do with the uncertainty about whether Russian flows will be cut off or not, and that's what we'll come to talk about.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Yes, we will talk about that later on. So, Jack, let me come to you then. Obviously, the main topic's going to be Russian flows, but give us a bit of background, first of all, on Europe's overall gas supply situation. How does Russia fit into that context?
I think it's good to start with a few big round numbers. So in the calendar year of 2021, last year, total implied European gas consumption was just under 490 BCM. And so that's a mixture of European production, pipeline imports, LNG imports, and net withdrawals from storage. And just to give you an idea of the balance between those different things, again, in very round numbers, European production was about 15% of supply, pipeline imports about 60%, LNG imports just under 20%, and then the remaining 5% was a net withdrawal from storage. So that is between the 1st of January and the 31st of December last year, we actually took out 19 BCM more from storage than we put in. Now, of course, in the winter, we take gas out of storage so that it contributes to supply, and in the summer, we inject it, so that share of supply basically turns negative. So, for example, last month, you know, February being a winter month, production, pipeline imports and LNG imports all accounted for slightly smaller shares of supply, and storage withdrawals accounted for almost a fifth. So that's the balance by share, if you like. In terms of where Russia fits into that, Russia and Norway are by far the largest pipeline suppliers to Europe. They predominantly supply Northwest Europe and Central Europe, and then In Southeast Europe, Russia is sort of to a certain extent in competition with Azerbaijan. And then finally, you have from Algeria and to a lesser extent Libya flows into Spain and Italy. So that's the geography and the broad outline of European gas supply.
Okay, thanks. And I guess what's been happening over the last 3 to 6 months has been of particular interest, because I think we're all aware that Russian gas flows have somewhat declined over Q4 and into 2022. So can you talk to us a little bit about what's happening to daily flows over the past 3 to 6 months?
So the pipeline flows from non-Russian suppliers, so Norway, North Africa and Azerbaijan, pretty much from Q4 through to the present have seemingly been pretty stable at their maximum capacity. That matters because it means that there isn't really much in the way of upside potential. In terms of flows from Russia, you rightly mentioned that flows declined in the fourth quarter of 2021. They were actually quite similar to the fourth quarter of 2020, but that puts them about 25% lower than the average for 2017 to 2019. Now, in January 2022, the flows from Russia dipped further with a limited recovery in the first 3 weeks of February. And then since the invasion, there has actually been a significant upsurge. A key point here, perhaps, is that Gazprom effectively withdrew from spot sales to Europe by mid-October last year. So these fluctuations in Russian pipeline flows are now being driven by nominations by Gazprom's European long-term contract counterparties. And I think perhaps Mike might like to add a comment on why that might be the case.
Yeah, I think the sort of the flows in terms of the contract volumes, I think we'll probably come on to. I think what's been happening in the market is that in the fourth quarter of last year, the monthly index price, which is what a lot of the Russian flows we think are sort of contracted on, the TTF monthly index, was sort of below the day ahead index. So the nominations were sort of quite high. And then that reversed in January. So what happened then was that the month index shot up quite sharply and the day ahead price was a little bit weaker. It was cheaper for the European buyers to buy gas on the market on the day ahead price, or take it out of storage. It was on the month on the contract. Therefore, they reduced their nominations. As we'll come to, that situation has been changing recently.
Okay, thanks for that. So, Jack, let me come back to you. I mean, let's talk about the different pipeline routes for Russian flows. Obviously, the Ukraine route of most interest, but what's been happening on the different pipeline routes and why is that important?
Well, to Northwest Europe, Russian gas is mainly provided by the Nord Stream 1 pipeline and the Yamal Europe pipeline, which goes from Belarus to Germany via Poland. Now, Poland also gets a third of its imports via that Yamal Europe route and another third via a smaller interconnection with Belarus. And what's been happening there is that Nord Stream 1 has remained pretty much at full capacity, although it did dip slightly in January. Of much greater interest has been the fluctuations on the Yamal Europe pipeline, which effectively fell to zero in January. And we saw physical imports back into Poland from Germany, which is a very unusual situation. In February, those Yamal Europe flows picked up slightly. And then in the last week of February, since the invasion, in line with this greater, broader uptick in Russian pipeline supply to Europe, as driven by counterparty nominations, we've seen these flows rise again. So now the flows on Yamal Europe are probably about 35% of the pipeline's capacity. That's about 35 million cubic meters per day. So there is still substantial available capacity on that route. In southeastern Europe, Bulgaria, Greece, North Macedonia, Serbia and Hungary all get their Russian gas via the Turkstream pipeline. And we measure that on the border between Turkey and Bulgaria. And there we saw, again, pipeline flows rise in at the end of February through to the 1st of March and then drop away slightly. But I think measuring the flows there is a little bit different because that's really quite limited by demand in the target markets. Finally, in terms of Ukraine, we had seen that in January, flows by Ukraine had fallen to as low as about 40% of the volume stipulated by Gazprom's long-term transit contract with the Ukrainian pipeline system operator, GTSOU. But again, since the 24th of February, the flows by Ukraine have rebounded to pretty much the full contractual capacity. That's about 110 million cubic meters per day. So again, this is all part of the broader uptick in supply. And the target market for those Ukrainian flows is Slovakia, Austria, Slovenia and Italy.
OK, thanks. Of course, there's not just pipelines, there's LNG as well. So maybe you could talk a little bit about LNG flows generally, but also talk a bit about Russian LNG and what's been happening there.
Well, Russia has two LNG export terminals, one in northwestern Russia and one in the Far East. In the Far East, the Sakhalin 2 export terminal focuses exclusively on exports to Asia, so it's not really part of the present discussion. The other pipeline in northwestern Russia, the Yamal LNG pipeline, has been operating significantly above its nameplate capacity since October. So its annual capacity is about 17.4 million tonnes per year, which equates to about 1.45 million tonnes per month. And actually, since October, we've seen production there of around 1.8 million tonnes per month. So well above the nameplate capacity, which is something that is possible during the winter months when you have a lower temperature differential between the ambient air temperature and the minus 160 degrees Celsius that you're aiming for to liquefy the gas. I think what's also notable is that the exports from Yamal LNG have been delivered almost exclusively to Europe in recent months. And I think that ties in then to the question of we've seen Russian LNG cargoes being turned away from the UK. But actually what is happening is that those cargoes are simply being regasified elsewhere in northwestern Europe.
OK, thanks. And Mike, let me come to you then on a broader LNG question. I think there's been some talk, at least, of much increased LNG imports into Europe. Can you talk a little bit about those and also talk about where those LNG imports are coming from?
Yeah, I mean, January was, I would call it, an astonishing month for LNG supply, and particularly almost a record month for imports into Europe, especially into the UK. A lot of these have really been coming from the US. I think, you know, over half Europe's LNG imports, I think, in February came from the US, which is a huge increase compared to what's happening. Part of that is additional US supply, as a lot of some of the terms which came on last year ramped up to full capacity and actually producing well above nameplate capacity. I think the other factor in it is if you can produce the LNG, then sending it to, let's say, the UK, to South Hook or Isle of Grain or Northwest Europe, rather than sending it to Japan, for example, it's the round trip time is half to send it to Europe than it is to send it to Japan. So one tanker can do twice as much work. So providing you can produce the LNG, get the throughput in the plant, then effectively you increase capacity, certainly by having additional shipping capacity available. I think that's been one factor as well, is you can use the capacity more intensively. But essentially, is the huge amount of US LNG being coming to the European markets to fill the gap left by lower Russian pipeline flows.
Okay, great, thanks. And Jack, let me come back to you now, because the other element of the supply side, obviously, is production within Europe. What's happening there? Still in decline, or have things turned around a bit with higher prices?
No, sadly, still in decline. The broad picture for Europe is one of a slow and steady decline, but there are a few countries in which we should particularly focus. So, for example, in the UK, production dipped in the middle part of last year as a result of maintenance that was held over from 2020 due to COVID. So we've seen UK production sort of rebound, although not growing. The other issue, of course, is Dutch gas production, where we've seen a dramatic decline over the last 5 to 7 years. There has been discussion around whether the Groningen field should indeed, as planned, cease production in the middle of 2022, and if they should be allowed to produce any additional volumes between now and then. The Dutch government seems to remain very much of the opinion that allowing additional Groningen production or extending the life of the field is very much a last resort. But I think a government decision on that is due in April. Finally, the other area where we could expect some bounce back, although sadly not this year, is Denmark. So there, the offshore platform at the Tyra field was taken offline for reconstruction. That was supposed to be back online by the middle of 2022. That's now been pushed back to the middle of 2023. But that accounts for about 90% of Danish production. So when that comes back on next year, that will make a small impact, let's say. But we're only expecting about 5 BCM per year of Danish production. So it doesn't really change the game in a broader European perspective. So to come back to the main question, really, I think we will see just a continued decline in European production.
Okay, and so I guess the key question then is where that leaves us with storage levels. Obviously, we went into the winter with pretty low storage levels, and there was some concern that we might actually run out. So how have things gone, and where are we now?
Well, we've been quite fortunate that it's been a relatively mild winter. There was indeed a lot of concern at the start of winter that we were going to end up with storage pretty well empty by the end of winter. Fortunately, storage withdrawals somewhat sort of flatlined around the Christmas period. Now we have about 27 BCM in storage, which is about 27% of storage capacity in broad numbers. We are slightly better off than we were in the immediate aftermath of the Beast from the East at the beginning of March 2018, but we remain significantly below where we were in other recent years. And I think this matters for two reasons. Firstly, it seems that by the end of winter, which would be, let's say, the end of the first week in April, generally speaking, in storage terms, at a point at which we would normally switch back to making net storage injections to start replenishing our seasonal stocks, we will probably end up with storage being at, if not a record low, then maybe the second lowest for several years, which implies that we have to put a lot back into storage, which will in effect act as another form of demand during the summer months when the market is already expected to be tight.
Okay, thanks. Interesting position we find ourselves in then. So Mike, let me come back to you. We've talked a little bit about the Russian volumes and the fact that it's, you know, some of the flows have been down to nominations, which have been affected by price differentials. But again, I think Jack mentioned that since the invasion, actually flows across the Ukraine system have gone right back up again. Is that purely commercial, or are people now taking more Russian volumes to kind of get them in as fast as possible before a potential crisis? What's going on now with volumes?
I think it is commercial. I mean, Jack mentioned they're also up on the Yamal-Urat route as well. So, but what we saw as the prices went up as a result of the invasion, the sort of day ahead price spiked well above the monthly index, and that was the monthly index in March is about sort of $26-$27 a million BTU, and prices are, you know, more than double that on the day ahead basis. So there's an incentive to nominate more under the long-term contracts. And it looks now, based on Jack's numbers, that we're actually above the sort of the take-or-pay levels under those contracts. So they're getting a little bit closer to the sort of the contract quantities. It is sort of commercially driven, I think, to get those nominations up. It's also true, I think, one of the German ministers commented the other day, that they're not going to stop taking Russian gas, and in fact encourage the German buyers to nominate higher under the contracts. That, I think, was one of the reasons why we saw the price fall 25% yesterday. Just a quick update on the price. I've been looking while I've been speaking. It's since we started speaking, it's fallen another 4%. So, I mean, it started the day, yeah, it sort of went up 10 euros a megawatt hour, went down 20 euros a megawatt hour, went back up 10 euros a megawatt hour, and has come down 3 euros a megawatt hour. So, I mean, it's, the market is a little bit crazy. But, I think it's commercial situation is what we're talking about.
Okay, thanks, Mike. I mean, talking of the prices, obviously, and the moving around, I mean, clearly they are anticipating or trying to anticipate what might happen to Russian flows. And I know you've done some work in the paper that was produced earlier this week on what happens if Russian flows are curtailed. So can you perhaps give us a little context around a kind of a normal gas flow year, and then what you think, let's start with the kind of the worst case scenario. What happens if Russian flows are cut off altogether?
Yes, I mean, so what we did in the paper and in talking about it, we looked at Central and Western Europe, which essentially is where most of the Russian gas goes. So you think of Europe, take out Turkey, Southeast Europe, you know, Greece and the Balkans, Spain, Portugal, and the UK, then the core Russian flows to the remaining countries in sort of Central and Western Europe. In a normal period, what happens is the total flow of gas, whether it's production, pipeline imports, LNG imports, coming into the market, is reasonably flattish throughout the year. So in the summer months, what we do is inject that surplus into storage. Jack's been talking about that. In the winter months, we sort of take it out to smooth the flows and then to meet the consumption patterns. So in terms of our scenario, and I must really, really emphasise, this is not a forecast of what will happen. The scenario we said, OK, let's switch off all Russian flows along Nord Stream 1, the Yamal-Yurt route and the Ukraine routes into Central and Western Europe for a whole year, starting on the 1st of April. So starting when, as Jack said, we expect stories to start to be filled. What happens, because obviously demand is lower in the summer, the lack of supply means we actually can't start the storage injection. In fact, what we'd have to do in the absence of any sort of mitigation measures is to actually continue taking gas out of storage to meet even the summer demand. So by the time you get to sort of about September, you know, the cupboard is bare, to quote a phrase from a poem. There's no more storage left. So then we're entering a period of rising demand coming into winter, no Russian imports, no gas in storage. So demand, it basically sort of gets, we call it gets destroyed. I mean, you just cannot meet the level of demand in the market. So that means possibly industrial closures, you know, lack of gas in power. You may be able to switch to other power sources, but the implication, of course, is quite a lot of sort of rolling blackouts and stuff. So it's quite a dire situation. But I emphasise, this is if you cut off all Russian supplies for a whole year.
You mentioned there mitigation. I think if I remember correctly from the report, you know, there is a kind of mitigation scenario. So what are the sort of the elements that could mitigate that worst case scenario, and what impact would they have?
Well, we talked about the possible mitigation in terms of where could we get additional supply from. Now there's the prospect, you know, compared to where we would be without all this, of maybe squeezing a little bit more out of the Groningen field. So, you know, production, rather than going down as we expect, might go up a little bit from Groningen. Possibility of bringing a few more pipeline imports out of Algeria, possibly Norway, Azerbaijan, for example. That might give you another sort of 10 BCM. And then in our estimation, you could probably get another 25 billion cubic metres out of LNG imports. Some of that would be, again, squeezing a little bit more supply out of the LNG export terminals, but a lot of it would be diversions at LNG away from other markets, particularly the Asian market. Particularly the China and India markets, diverting LNG away from that. So that overall, into supply terms, would give us another 40 BCM, which would sort of postpone, if you like, the unmet demand period from September to sort of early December. But obviously, you're not meeting demand in the height of a winter.
And obviously, as you mentioned, there's diversion from other markets. So presumably, there's a price implication of that as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, who knows where the price will go in terms of that? I mean, it's you know, it's gone crazy. Even the thought of Russian flows being curtailed. So, I mean, the price would, it's almost unlimited, but it kind of ceases to be almost a measure of how you get flows here. European prices would go up enormously, I'd imagine, but it's. It almost ceases to be an assessment of how tight the market is. It's just unknown how high they could go.
And you've mentioned, you know, various ways we could find extra supply or mitigate demand. I mean, obviously the IEA have brought out their 10-point plan for reducing dependence on Russian exports, and the EU have now come out with some pronouncements as well. How do the OIES forecasts and sort of mitigation scenarios compare with what the IEA and the EU have been saying?
Well, we just looked really just on the where supply could be obtained from to replace the lost Russian supply. We didn't go into the sort of demand side. And in fact, we were probably a bit more optimistic in terms of LNG diversions than the IEA were. The IEA also looked at how you might sort of curtail demand for gas or demand for energy, one of which was turn your thermostat down 1°C, save 10 BCM. Together with you know, bringing forward some solar and wind and a few other changes, you could maybe, in effect, reduce the demand in inverted commas for gas by about another 30 BCM. But again, that still doesn't get us all the way to the level of demand that is being unmet. So we've still got a hole if we do have the disruption of Russian flows for a whole year. So as the EU plan, that's just sort of come out really very recently. I mean, it's only the last couple of days. So having read that, I mean, they have sort of similar ways of limiting the fallout of Russian flows. They assumed that Russia imports were reduced by 2/3 over a year, which is about a reduction of 100 BCM. Not as bad as our complete closure scenario. But they thought about 50 BCM could come from additional LNG imports, which is obviously even more diversions away from other markets. And then they were majoring really on sort of the demand side measures, as the IEA did, sort of similar sorts of numbers. However, one problem with the EU plan, one of the problems, is they also want to impose by legislation order the European companies to put at least to fill storage up to 90% by sort of early October, which means you need to get about 90 BCM of gas into European storage, which would imply a fill of possibly around 70 BCM this summer. And that is sort of 25 to 30 BCM above what was injected last summer. So you're actually adding another 30 BCM to your demand compared to last year. And who knows where that would come from? It doesn't seem to be consistent to reduce Russian flows by 100 BCM, even if you could replace that or mitigate that and then add another 30 BCM demand, effective demand or requirement to the market. So I think it's it needs a bit more analysis, shall we say, in terms of the EU plan.
Okay. And I guess we should also address the fact that, as you mentioned, the EU scenario is for a slightly smaller decline in Russia exports. And I guess there is the chance, for example, that only the Ukrainian system would be impacted, perhaps by the impact of the war, and we only lose the 40 BCM through Ukraine. I guess in that scenario, there's capacity elsewhere if Russia decided to send the gas to use other systems.
There's some. I mean, Jack explained that the volumes on the Yamal Europe have gone up. So compared to the situation as of this point in time, if all the flows along the Ukraine were disrupted because of damage to infrastructure, we're losing about 100 million cubic metres a day. But there's probably, based on Jack's numbers, maybe another 50 or 60 million cubic metres a day you could divert down Yamal Europe. So some of it you could replace, and I think physically the Russian system can do that, but you could not replace all the amount coming through Ukraine by diversions to Yamal Europe. So the market would get quite a bit tighter.
Okay, I just want to finish with prices again. And I know you've said that, you know, it's almost impossible to sort of second guess what the market might do if there was an interruption. I think perhaps a more interesting question is, if there's no interruption and if the situation in Ukraine calms down, where do you think the market would go then? I mean, what are the fundamentals telling us about where the price would end up if the situation, by some miracle, actually calms down and there's not an interruption?
Yes, just a quick update on the price. It's not changed in the last 5 minutes, so that's unusual. But in terms of if things calm down a bit for whatever reason, and I think if we look back and said, okay, in the next 2 weeks, flows from Russia are going to increase by 50 or 60% in a market where we're getting a lot of LNG, you know, in the absence of invasion of Ukraine, prices would have collapsed. So there's still a big fear premium sort of left in the market. So if you could say that it, with reasonable certainty, that gas flows from Russia would not be curtailed or interrupted, even if the war sort of, you know, continued to carry on, then the market could well settle down quite a bit at much, much lower levels of prices. But there'd have to be a high degree of confidence that Russia flows will be maintained, i.e. no sanctions, and Russia itself would not turn off the taps. We may be a bit away from that, but you could see a lot lower prices. And if they did turn off the taps or by sanctions or Russia decide not to send the gas, then, you know, the prices will go through the roof again. So there's a wide range, but I think there does appear to be sufficient supply with Russia flowing at much higher volumes and with more LNG supply coming on this year, that even compared to last year under that scenario, with the supply coming on, the prices could actually be could weaken considerably. But there's a lot of uncertainty in the market.
Indeed, we can only hope that that scenario transpires. It certainly, as we sit here, doesn't look like that at the moment. Anyway, look, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much, Mike, for your insights and obviously for your price, your regular price updates. Thanks, Jack, for your thoughts as well. That's been fascinating. The paper is available on the OIES website. It's called The Russian Ukraine Invasion Impact on European Gas Markets. So look out for it there. With that, thank you again for listening. Please do go to our website and see all our research. And we'll speak to you again shortly on another OIES podcast. Thank you very much indeed, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.